I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Six American soldiers were killed yesterday when their Black Hawk helicopter crashed in southern Afghanistan, apparently because of mechanical problems. That's the largest number of foreign deaths in 6 months. In spite of this tragedy, NATO casualties in Afghanistan this year have dropped dramatically as it gets ready to leave the country at the end of 2014. Meanwhile, as many as 70 Iraqis have been killed in the last few days in a way of sectarian violence that is raising concerns about a civil war in that country. Our guest is retired Lieutenant Colonel John Nagle. He led a tank platoon in the Persian Gulf War and was operations officer of a tank battalion task force in the Iraq War. He's the author of a book that came out a couple of years ago called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife and is one of the architects or draftsmen, as he said, of U.S. counterinsurgency operations used in Iraq and Afghanistan. And after a long and distinguished military career, he made an unusual career switch this year. He's now the headmaster of the Haverford School. That's a prep school just outside of Philadelphia. And John Nagle joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and it's nice to finally meet you. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Marty.
There's so much I want to talk to you about, and I do want to begin with Afghanistan. And as we know, about a year from now, the plan is to move most of NATO forces, U.S. troops, out of that country. What do you think needs to be done in the next year to stabilize that country and make that transition smoother than what it appears to be today?
Wow, that's a big question.
It is.
So first, let me begin by remembering the six service members who were lost in the helicopter downing. Reminder that the war in Afghanistan does go on, that there are still 70,000 or so American troops in the country, part of an international force of some 87,000, in support of an Afghan security force of some 400,000. And ultimately, the success or failure of Afghanistan is going to depend on those Afghan security forces, their capabilities, their determination, but also in no small part on whether and to what extent the United States and our allies continue to support them. Mm. And so the critical issue in Afghanistan right now is a security framework agreement that the United States has presented to President Karzai, that President Karzai took to a loyal Jirga, sort of a parliamentary, a very broad parliamentary decision-making body. It was endorsed by the loyal Jirga, and President Karzai then extremely unexpectedly chose not to sign it, a decision that has occasioned, it is safe to say, dismay across not just the American body politic, the national security community, the international security community, but also Afghanistan itself. And fascinatingly, as we tie together the two subjects we're going to talk about largely today, Iraq and Afghanistan, the Iraqi foreign minister, Mr. Zebari, recently visited Afghanistan, his first visit, and told President Karzai, whatever you do, sign this agreement. Iraq is suffering because it doesn't have the support of American special operating forces, American intelligence assets. You need that help. And he pointed out correctly, Afghanistan needs the help a whole lot more than Iraq does, and Iraq can't handle its threats on its own.
You have written about modern wars and the fact that modern wars, at least the last couple of decades of war, don't seem to end with signing ceremonies where then you put countries back together. I'm thinking of World War II as a pretty obvious example. Now we have sort of disorganized ends of wars and low levels of conflict. Is that how we should think of war these days?
I'm afraid it is. The good news is that organized violence and even disorganized violence is killing a smaller percentage of the human population than has apparently ever been the case since prehistoric times. And the best author on the subject, Steven Pinker, with an interesting book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, the 20th century, the bloodiest century in American history, but the 50 years since, far more peaceful. And the same factors that have led to a diminution in organized violence, human on human, nuclear weapons, the conventional military superiority of the United States that I saw firsthand in Operation Desert Storm in particular, have pushed warfare away from the centerpiece of human existence, but have made in some ways the world safe for disorganized war, for insurgencies, for terrorism, for much smaller kinds of wars that are unlikely to result in clean, satisfying ends, because we're not fighting states, we're fighting sub-state groups, small groups of in many cases, very committed ideologues who are going to ultimately, I think, fade away into some degree of strategic irrelevance, and I would argue that Al-Qaeda Central has already largely done that. But so the wars are not going to come to a clean end. They're going to have a very long and difficult tale, as the loss of those six service members reminds us.
Well, and indeed, and it seems that these groups still continue to metastasize in certain ways. We see them apparently in Syria. We saw them in Mali. We see, while Osama bin Laden is not around, it seems that these groups are still operating under some kind of ideology and some kind of leadership.
That's exactly right. And Syria is a great example of just how complicated and unsatisfying international security issues are likely to be for the foreseeable future. So in Syria, obviously, the Assad regime, a horrible regime, uses chemical weapons against its own people. Horrible, awful. But the insurgent groups rising up against it are also not particularly pleasant people, many of them affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And unfortunately, as the United States tries to help overthrow the Assad regime, some of the assistance we've given to those rebel groups appears to have fallen into the hands of Al-Qaeda affiliates. And so we really are in a case where we don't want Assad to rule, but we also don't want the rebels to win. That is the kind of future, I'm afraid, we're likely to face as dictators around the globe lose some of their ability to control their own people because of information technology, the Twitter revolutions that have marked what the so-called Arab Spring across much of the Islamic world. The empowered people empowered with information, are less likely to submit to governments. But the insurgent groups don't necessarily have clean hands either.
You're one of, as you reminded me before we go in the air, saying I wasn't an architect, I was a draftsman, but nonetheless, one of the thinkers that went into the American counterinsurgency policy, the idea of winning over hearts and minds. Under these conditions, how do you win over hearts and minds of people when they probably want schools for their children, they want roads that work, they want electricity, they want hospitals, they want some degree of justice? Is that all connected, or is hearts and minds over here and infrastructure over there?
So great, and another very big question. It's important to understand that there are many different groups inside these societies. The vast majority of the people in Syria, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, want just the things you described. They want good jobs. They want good schools to send their kids to. They want to be safe. Above all, they want to be safe. But there are small groups inside all of those societies that while they may want those things, they want other things more. They want power for themselves. They are committed ideologues. They believe in many cases, an Islamic caliphate. This is the driving idea behind Al-Qaeda. They want to overthrow the governments across the Islamic world and replace them with regimes that follow Sharia, a very strict form of Islamic law. And they are willing to put at risk other people's children and their own children in order to achieve those objectives. And so those different groups want different things, and I think we have to try to disaggregate them. And this was one of the critical realizations in Iraq, that the majority of the Iraqi people, even the majority of the Sunnis in Al-Anbar, where I was fighting in 2003-2004, were not necessarily supporters of the insurgency, certainly weren't fighters in the insurgency, but they enabled and allowed those insurgent fighters to live within them. And so you get Mao's wonderful phrase that the insurgents are fish swimming in the sea of the people. Ultimately, to win these wars, we need to change the sea in which they swim. We need to make it less congenial to the insurgents. But ultimately, it's not going to be Americans who do that. The host nations have to do that themselves.
If people, though, are fighting for their own survival, it's sort of hard to imagine thinking some of those lofty thoughts.
That is certainly true. And this was important for me to understand. So I was fighting in Al-Anbar in 03, 04, and we had the horrible events in Fallujah where the American contractors' bodies, they were killed, their bodies were desecrated, and we attacked Fallujah, I think, unwisely. against the advice of the commanders on the ground, who wanted to do fairly precision strikes, but we conducted a very broad scale assault into Fallujah, and Iraq erupted. Sunnis and Shias came together for the first time since Saddam Hussein's government had been toppled, and they rose up and all agreed on one thing for the first time, which was that we were bad. And I received credible intelligence that the police chief I was working with in my town in Chaldea, just next door to Fallujah, was providing arms, weapons, body armor to the insurgents inside Fallujah, despite the fact that I was working with him to build security in my own town. My assessment was he was playing both sides. My assessment was that was what he had to do to stay alive at that particular point. And in fact, he faced a number of assaults on himself personally, survived an improvised explosive device, a roadside bomb attack on him in his own driveway, which just gives you a sense of how difficult, how complicated the positions we're putting people are. What positions we're putting people in those kind of wars, and to understand the very difficult decisions, survival level decisions they're making on a daily basis. It is not you're with us or against us.
Well, which is interesting, and it does raise questions about what does it make any sense anymore to have a kind of invasion war like in Iraq or even Afghanistan? And there, I've always felt, and I might have even talked to you about this in some previous interview, that when someone comes to quote-unquote liberate you, there is something humiliating about that because it says you cannot liberate yourself. We know better than you what your life should be about.
Mm-hmm. So your next hour, I know, is invasive species.
It is invasive species.
And of course, much of the Middle East would say that the United States, that Americans are an invasive species. I think in general you're right. That is, the United States should look at invasion and regime change as a last resort. And one of the real tragedies of this last decade of war has been that the Iraq War didn't need to be fought, was fought on what turned out to be false intelligence. A man I admire very much, a good thinker, Richard Haass, wrote a book called War of Necessity, War of Choice, comparing the Desert Storm invasion of Iraq, which I think was necessary, with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, which he called a war of choice, and which I believe was not necessary. All that said, I think the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 was absolutely necessary, was legal by international law, was necessary to protect the people of the United States against further al-Qaeda attacks, was the first step toward if not eliminating, at least eliminating al-Qaeda completely, at least eliminating it as a strategic threat to the United States. So there are going to be times when we have to we may have to do this again, but we should measure twice before we cut once, and lots of lessons from the misguided decision to invade Iraq.
And I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's John Nagle. He's a retired lieutenant colonel, one of the draftsmen or one of the architects of U.S. counterinsurgency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's currently the new headmaster at the Haverford School, kind of a career switch for him. That's in suburban Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break. Get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
The Fleischer Art Memorial supports WHYY and offers individuals an opportunity to explore their creative side this winter. Fleischer has a 116-year tradition of providing art classes for thousands of children and adults from throughout the Delaware Valley. There are 70-plus workshops in drawing, painting, photography, sculpting, and more, taught by Fleischer's noted faculty. The winter term begins January 6th. Registration and more information is available at Fleischer.org.
This Week in This American Life.
If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what are you kidding me?
A car dealership in Long Island tries to sell its monthly quota of cars, 129 cars. It's not going well.
I want balloons in the showroom. I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Will it work? Find out this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, I'll take a new bike out for a spin that gives riders a boost.
So we're going downhill right now, so it's not hard anyway.
But if I pedal backwards,
it starts to capture your energy and convert it into electrical, storing it in the batteries.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. I'm talking with John Noggle, again, a retired lieutenant colonel. We're talking about war, I guess, and war and peace. He served in Iraq in the first Iraq war, the second Iraq war, and has been part of the thinking in this country about the value of counterinsurgency operations. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Picking up on what you said about just that we have to have a great deal of reluctance about going to war. You need good intelligence. You need reliable intelligence. There's certainly questions about drones, whether drones are a kind of substitute for war and whether they create more enemies than the people that they actually kill. Let me start with the intelligence part. And there's so much, of course, with NSA now. So how can we rely on intelligence to tell us good information about a possible or a potential war?
Certainly not completely. And doctoral dissertations will be written on the decision to invade Iraq for 100 years to come, as well they should. One of the worst decisions ever made by the United States, in my opinion. But the intelligence community is very, very good in many ways. You mentioned the National Security Agency at collecting data. What we're not as good at is converting raw data into intelligence, and in particular into understanding the motivations behind other states' actions. And I'm a fan of the book Thinking in Time by Ernest May and Richard Neustadt, who recommend trying to put yourself in the shoes of your opponent and seeing the world from their perspective. And so as we're making the decision to invade Iraq in 2002, 2003, Saddam Hussein refused to reveal information on his weapons of mass destruction programs, which it turned out he had destroyed a decade earlier, largely in the wake of Operation Desert Storm, and we couldn't understand if he had destroyed them, why he wouldn't tell us. And in fact, what we should have realized was that Saddam Hussein was far more concerned about Iran than he was about the United States, and so he was holding. He was bluffing, but he was trying to convince the Iranians, with whom he fought an incredibly bloody war, a much worse war for him than Operation Desert Storm, through the decade of the 1980s. He was trying to make sure that Iran didn't believe that he was weak and wasn't going to invade him. And so if we had thought more deeply about Saddam Hussein's perspective, I think we would have interpreted the intelligence differently. And this is the kind of cultural intelligence that we most need as we think about the international security situation we face.
And the cultural intelligence meaning understanding different cultures. And I wonder whether we should rethink this idea of American exceptionalism, that somehow, you know, we know better than the rest of the world, or we're better than the rest of the world.
I'm a big fan of the classic film of strategic thought, Stripes, by Bill Murray.
Oh,
and
I didn't know where you were going with that.
And in Stripes, Bill Murray, trying to work with a platoon of American recruits, says, "We're Americans. Our ancestors were kicked out of every decent country in the world." And so Bill Murray is certainly right that we are exceptional. There are many ways to use that word. I think the United States is my wife is European, was a British citizen, became an American citizen. One of the things that she was fascinated by was the reverence we have for the flag and for our national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner. We are unique. We are truly exceptional in our reverence for our flag. And the reason we are so reverent is that Bill Murray was right. We are not united by a common language, by common ancestry, by ethnic origin, by religion. So what holds us together is an idea, and it's an idea of liberty. That idea of liberty should mean that we are very respectful of other people's ideas of liberty as well. And so we need to be enormously careful as the world's only superpower, as the greatest power probably in history, certainly mm-hmm. since Rome. We need to be very judicious about the use of our power as we pursue our interests both here and abroad.
I remember this is, gosh, decades ago, Madeleine Albright complaining to Colin Powell. This, I think, had to do with Rwanda, basically saying to him, what's the point of this big military if we're not willing to use it? We have a gigantic military. You served in it, and it's the largest the world has ever seen. And it's always been an interesting question to me.
I think that case was Bosnia, actually, not
Bosnia.
Rwanda, although,
okay.
Both were are relevant for the discussion and were difficult choices made by the Clinton administration on whether to intervene or not. We actually, interestingly, don't have that big of a military. It's not the biggest in the world by a pretty fair shot, and it's getting smaller, but we do have an enormously powerful and capable one. We also have extraordinary responsibilities around the globe, and a topic for debate, a discussion we should have as Americans is whether we are going to be remain willing to carry out those responsibilities. Right. And so the world has enjoyed an extraordinary period of economic growth since the end of the Second World War. The United States, largely because of its economic power, defeated the Soviet Union in the Cold War, a war which could have gone very, very badly. And largely as a result of the international security framework the United States has established, continues to maintain, China in particular, East Asia in general, has enjoyed extraordinary economic growth. More people have come out of poverty faster in China than in any other, over the last 30 years, than in any other period of the Earth's history. So there are enormous benefits, I believe, that both the United States and the world derive from our military, our foreign policy, when used judiciously. But it is also expensive. And,
yes.
and the American people, I think, should think through more carefully what it is they're paying for, what benefits they derive from doing so, particularly at a time when the international energy situation is swinging so rapidly in our favor. Whole different topic of discussion.
It is, but you're saying because of oil and oil
because,
politics.
Because
and,
of fracking, yeah. the United States now a net energy exporter, right? The first time that's happened in at least 50 years. And so the country that cares most about a free supply of oil is now China. But China is not, as the United States does, guaranteeing freedom of action, freedom of movement, freedom of the seas, and in fact is taking actions that, mm-hmm. that tend to diminish that right. And so one of the big questions, I think, for international politics over the next 50 years is going to be the ascent of China to true great power status and whether China will become a responsible stakeholder in the international system.
I'm throwing a lot of hard questions at you, but just picking up on what you were saying earlier and even going back to Syria, and whose heart doesn't break when you read about these refugees that have fled for their life, the number of people that have been killed, not just by chemical weapons weapons, children who have been dying in streets and dying in refugee camps. I mean, what does a country like the United States do about that, if anything?
Syria is a particularly painful discussion because, as I said earlier, there are no good options for the United States right now. The Assad regime is horrible, tortures its own people. But the sad truth is that the organizations that are looking to overthrow him are, in many cases, al-Qaeda-affiliated and are not necessarily likely to provide a much better government or one more in U.S. and our friends in the region's interests than the Assad regime itself. And this is a case of a window of opportunity closing. And so back in the summer of 2012, there were, I think, a number of insurgent groups, freedom fighters, fighting against the Assad regime, and there was a recommendation made by then Secretary of State Clinton, among others, that we arm and equip some of those rebel fighters. We chose not to do so, and over the 6 months to a year that followed, as often happens in a rebellion, those groups were killed off in internecine warfare against other rebels and replaced by the most brutal, who are also largely al-Qaeda affiliates. And so there really isn't a good choice here unless the United States is willing to secure the peace after toppling Assad. Mm-hmm. And so what we've learned to our dismay over the last decade or so is that overthrowing a government is relatively easy. It presents targets, fixed targets that American firepower can be used to destroy. The hard part is what comes after.
Do you think President Obama is overly skittish, if I can say that, about sending in U.S. troops?
I think that President Obama, it's interesting, he is criticized by some for decisions like not intervening decisively in Syria. He's also criticized, on the other hand, for a fairly vigorous use of drones, of unmanned aerial systems, in particular in Pakistan, also in Afghanistan, a number of places around the globe, which have been used to, among other things, kill American citizens in a few very remarkable cases. And so I think it would be painting too broadly to say that President Obama is skittish about the use of force. I think that he is perhaps, he is appropriately, in my eyes, cautious about committing American ground troops to combat. And so one of the big questions in strategic studies, in the subject I've spent much of my life thinking about, is to what extent these unmanned systems are a revolution in warfare.
Right.
Do we have the right legal safeguards to govern their use? Do we have the right international prohibitions on their use? And as that technology proliferates, as all technology does, how are we going to protect ourselves against other countries that have these unmanned, very similar unmanned systems in years to come? It's a fascinating and wide open field of study.
Let me reintroduce you. That's John Nagle. He's a retired lieutenant colonel. He led a tank platoon in the Persian Gulf War, was operations officer of a tank battalion task force in the Iraq War, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, and one of the drafters, the architects of U.S. counterinsurgency operations used both in Iraq and Afghanistan, made an interesting career switch. He's now the headmaster of the Haverford School.
It's full of insurgents.
That's what we learned, actually, before going on the air. And he's that's a prep school just outside of Philadelphia. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to, it looks like Tim from Chester County to join us. Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much.
You're so
Colonel,
welcome.
Colonel, it's a pleasure to have the chance to listen to you. I want to take up, I just want to get your take on this idea of securing the peace, which I think is something that has not really happened in Iraq and not likely to happen in Afghanistan. It's particularly concerning to me and my family. We have a daughter that is currently serving in Afghanistan. I have another daughter who was previously deployed there, and a son-in-law who was on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, all these in the last 3 years. So as, the tide of war is receding, as we are winding these operations down, I'm just wondering, what do I tell my children we've accomplished there?
Well, Tim, first of all, my thanks to you for calling in, and obviously my thanks to your children, your son-in-law, for their service as well. It's an important question. John Nagle, what do you say?
Tim, let me echo those thanks. You've got a remarkable family that's doing their part for the security of the nation and, as we just discussed, the world. Also, your question allows me to highlight the incredibly important role women have played in these in the wars of the last decade. We literally could not have made it. The all-volunteer force would have collapsed without the contributions of women in both wars. Huge credit is owed to them. Securing the peace. So I'm a product of a Jesuit education and a big fan of St. Augustine's statement that the purpose of a war is to build a better peace. We, I think, did not fully appreciate that. We did not have the doctrine we needed as a military, as a government, did not have the capabilities we needed to build a better peace either in Iraq or in Afghanistan after we toppled those governments. That said, the decision to invade Iraq in 2003, that unnecessary decision, as I've said, meant that we took an awful lot of resources away from Afghanistan that could have been used there to more rapidly could have very possibly prevented a Taliban insurgency from erupting in the first place. Certainly could have We could be at a very different place in Afghanistan and would be, I think, if we had not chosen to invade Iraq in 2003. All that said, it is my belief that President Karzai will ultimately sign the security framework, that the United States will leave some probably slightly less than 10,000 troops in Afghanistan, probably for the long haul.
Like forever?
Well, it's important to note that 65 years after the end of the Second World War, we still have troops in Germany, Italy, and Japan. When the United States cares enough to send its very best, they stay. And when you look back on the history of American military interventions, the only place we still don't have troops is Vietnam. Right, and they'd like us actually to have an aircraft carrier stationed in Cameron Bay because of the security situation there. The world has turned, so we are likely to have troops in Afghanistan for as long as Pakistan continues to face internal insurgent threats, and so what your son-in-law, your daughters have accomplished in the region, I believe, I hope, and I pray is a stable Afghan government, and I believe the government in Afghanistan will stand as long as America continues to frankly pay for the Afghan security forces, some $4 or $5 billion a year, an awful lot of money, but an awful lot less than we're paying now. We're much closer to $100 billion a year right now in Afghanistan than we are to that $4 or $5 billion. Mm-hmm. As long as the United States provides the funding for Afghan security forces, Afghanistan will stand, the government will stand, it will continue to face an internal insurgency that will largely be dealt with by Afghan security forces themselves. The American troops in the region, stationed in the region in cooperation with Afghan forces, particularly Afghan special forces, will cut the heads off of the, literally, in some cases, the flowers that rise highest, the most dangerous insurgent groups, particularly the al-Qaeda affiliates. And perhaps most importantly, we will have a perspective on the situation inside Pakistan, which remains, in my eyes, the most dangerous place in the world for American national security interests and will for the rest of my life.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So picking up on what you just said back to Tim, so do you see then the future of, quote-unquote, I guess, war or dealing with some of these conflicts or threats, the use of special forces, drones, spying, I mean, those kinds of things versus sending in battalions of soldiers?
So I hope so. The problem of insurgency is not going to go away. We've seen insurgents and rebellions rising up all across the Middle East. The country in the world that is most concerned about this trend is actually China, which faces a whole lot of so far small rebellions against its own government. It is very concerned by the Arab Spring and the lessons of the Arab Spring. And so rebellions are going to continue. In most cases, countries can deal with them internally and should. In some cases where those rebellions present a threat to governments that are our friends, we will be helping those governments. In some cases, we won't talk about it at all. We have covert agencies that do some of that work. In some cases, there will be special forces teams that do it. Only in the rarest cases, I believe, will the United States intervene with conventional troops. That doesn't mean we should throw away the hard-learned lessons of the last decade in how to do that, but we should, if we're smart, we can inoculate countries against rebellion, we can help them build their own security forces, and they can handle the heavy lifting themselves. That should be the objective of American policy.
And that's John Nagle, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, a retired lieutenant colonel. He's currently the headmaster of the Haverford School, a prep school just outside of Philadelphia. And we are talking about some of the lessons learned and not learned from the last decade or so of wars. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
20 years ago, Sue Ellen Cailor was an extra in a movie.
In the courtroom scene, I was right there in the middle.
It was a proud moment, but not a happy one.
Because this case is not just about AIDS, is it?
I'm Mike and Scott. Next time on The Pulse, Philadelphia came out 20 years ago. A look at the film's impact, legacy, and the distance traveled in fighting HIV and AIDS.
Here's my patient list. I mean, here's my long list of people who died.
The Pulse, Friday at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Pope Francis and his first year with James Carroll, who profiles the Pope in The New Yorker. And we'll discuss Carroll's conflicted relationship with the Church. He's a former priest who welcomed the reforms of Vatican II and left the priesthood after the Church reverted to conservative positions. He's written extensively about the Church. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A Galileo of our time, minus a skeptical Pope and the accusations of heresy.
The more scientific our society is, the better it will be.
Physicist and science explainer Brian Cox, whose work owes a bigger debt surely to the late Carl Sagan than Galileo. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In just about a year, NATO troops are scheduled to withdraw from Afghanistan. That would mark the end of America's longest war. President Obama is currently negotiating with President Hamid Karzai about keeping a small force in that country to train and advise Afghan troops. Meanwhile, in Iraq, a sharp increase in violence by al-Qaeda affiliates has raised some serious concerns about that country's security. We're talking about all of this, including U.S. foreign policy, with our guest, John Nagel, a retired lieutenant colonel, one of the architects of U.S. counterinsurgency operations in those two countries, and again, the new headmaster at the Haverford School. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Ken calling us from Abington. Ken, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My question revolves around the early stages of the war and the whole idea of insurgency and how you identify just who is the insurgency in a messy conflict like we have in Iraq, right, almost from the beginning. Complicated probably because of the historic nature of pretty much three distinct groups of people being put within the borders of one country when it was first carved out after colonialism. So your guest hinted about disaggregating the different parties, and that's something I've always had a trouble with. And the term insurgency kind of came up very quickly in the conflict, and it seems like it was labeling some quote-unquote outside force, but these were really people within Iraq in many cases that reacted to the invasion. So I'd really love to have his take on how he thinks of what the insurgency is actually made up of and how it started, who they are versus the people in Iraq that he believes are the core that could build a successful nation.
Well, Ken, I appreciate that. The call to Radio Times. John Nagel, go ahead.
Very well-informed question, Ken. And you're absolutely right. The country of Iraq was formed as part of the post-colonial British retreat from empire. The Sunni, Shia, and Kurds fit together relatively uneasily, but it ended up working for many years reasonably well, particularly under the hands of a strong man, a dictator named Saddam Hussein, who was able to maintain some degree of comity among those groups. But a minority of the population was Sunni, while Saddam was Sunni, and he concentrated power in the hands of the Sunnis. And so when we toppled Saddam Hussein's government and imposed some form of democracy on the country, the majority Shia, for the first time, had the power that their numbers arguably meant that they deserved. But the Sunnis obviously didn't like that very much. And it took us a long time, I think too long, to figure out as a nation fighting this. Frankly, we should have seen that coming. And some of my friends, Conrad Crane, another Army colonel, at the Army War College, wonderful man. Conrad Crane was one of the people who predicted that this would happen. The Sunni rose up in rebellion against the new regime, against their loss of power, their loss of control. And what we faced, particularly in Al-Anbar, where I was fighting a almost exclusively Sunni area. We faced a largely Sunni rebellion, although we also had al-Qaeda move in, and we were fighting some al-Qaeda when I was there in 03 and 04, but important to note that al-Qaeda wasn't there. Saddam Hussein did not allow al-Qaeda in. There were no connections, next to no connections, certainly no substantive connections between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. And so we faced a domestic insurgency against the overthrow of a Sunni regime. It became an international insurgency. It became the cause celeb for al-Qaeda. It became the U.S. invasion of Iraq became the greatest boost to al-Qaeda's recruiting since the formation of the organization. And so we really helped al-Qaeda out by invading Iraq in 2003. Mm-hmm. This is the thesis of a wonderful book by Peter Bergen called The Longest War, which I commend to you highly. And we were very, very fortunate that, largely because of the efforts of David Petraeus, a man whose name has not yet been mentioned in this program, and the soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors who fought in the surge, as well as the brave Iraqis who fought against that Sunni insurgency, we managed to create some degree of a reasonable outcome from what looked like it was going to be, when I was departing Iraq in 2004, an even more epic tragedy than it turned out to be.
This is a more personal question, but do you struggle with the fact that you fought in a war, as you said, that was an unnecessary war? That was, those are your words, but nonetheless, there you were, you know, fighting in Al-Anbar province.
I'm not sure I go so far as to say it was an unjust war. I do believe it was an unnecessary war, and I do struggle with that. The Jesuits taught me well. The use ad bellum, the use of justice for, in terms of fighting a war, is not a decision that rests with a soldier. It was my job as a soldier to conduct use in bello, to fight the war justly as well as I could at my level, very difficult in this kind of dirty counterinsurgency campaign. I wear the names of the soldiers, the 18 soldiers in my task force who we lost in Al-Anbar in 2003-2004 around my wrist. The fact that they were lost in a war that is unnecessary, that their spouses are widows, that their children are orphans, that many of them never got to see their unborn children, is something that leads me to urge caution. Yeah. As we think about further military interventions, to try hard to teach the lessons of these wars, and to urge that the United States, which has this abundance of power, this extraordinary power, the most important country in the world, uses that power as wisely and as judiciously as it possibly can, always being conscious of the law of unintended consequences.
And take better care of returning soldiers and Marines.
And another book, David Finkel, a good friend of mine, Finkel's book, Thank You for Your Service.
Yes.
A phenomenal book about what happened to the soldiers of 216 Infantry, battalion commanded by one of my West Point classmates that came back from the surge to Fort Riley, Kansas, and had a number of soldiers struggle with the invisible wounds of this war, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress. We will be taking care of those who fought on our behalf for generations to come, and we owe them everything.
We certainly do, and we were talking during the break about that 1%. It's the 1% of this country, including you, that serve in our military, and this is a volunteer force, and I know that you think that's a good thing, as opposed to a bunch of draftees.
So one of the very few silver linings to what has been in some ways a very dark cloud of military and strategic issues over the last decade has been the success of the all-volunteer force. When we created an all-volunteer force, got rid of the draft in the wake of Vietnam, no one would have expected that an all-volunteer force would prevail, would continue, would operate through a decade of war, much less through a decade of two wars. And in fact, the all-volunteer military is in many ways stronger at the end of this more than 12 years now of war than it was when we started. It's an extraordinary tribute to the leadership of the armed forces and to the young men and women like Tim's daughters we talked about earlier, his son-in-law, who volunteer to serve in these wars. But those young men and women deserve political leadership that is conscious of their absolute adherence to orders and to duty.
Let me get another Tim to join us. This is Tim from Hillsboro joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I served twice in Afghanistan and once in Iraq. And what bothers me about the Karzai government is a lot of things. I mean, they have a lot of levels of corruption, as most governments do. But my concern is whenever there are deaths in Afghanistan of civilians, you know, the U.S. government apologizes and we send money and we reveal. But when U.S. forces and NATO forces are killed in Afghanistan, the Karzai government doesn't even, you know, acknowledge it. And that really bothers me a great deal. I mean, I understand the problems that are going on there. And I would agree with the colonel saying that, you know, we took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan and we put all our resources in Iraq, and that hurt us in the long run. I mean, but it still bothers me that the Karzai government, they don't show any compassion.
Well, Tim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, your service as well. Let me give John Nagle a chance to respond.
Tim, I couldn't agree with you more. President Karzai is enormously difficult to deal with, enormously frustrating. And his ingratitude for the sacrifices that Americans, our NATO allies, our non-NATO allies, countries like Australia have made to build a better future for his country are infuriating. Mm. That said, and please be angry about that. You're fully justified in doing so. That said, it is important for all Americans to realize that we are not a charity organization. We want the people of Afghanistan to have a brighter future and a better life, particularly the women of Afghanistan who suffer horribly under Taliban rule, would suffer again if the Taliban returned to power, which is what I'm afraid would happen if the United States did not continue to support the Afghan government, President Karzai, and his successor. That's not why we're there. We are there because, and we will keep, I believe, an American presence in Afghanistan for the long haul in order to stabilize a region and keep a region that is very dangerous to us, a region from which we were brutally attacked on September 11th, a region which, though less dangerous to the United, to the interests of the United States, remains a source of infection of Al-Qaeda, sleaze, slime. I'm struggling for sufficiently horrific words to describe how bad the infection in that part of the world is. We are keeping a lid on that, and we have, and it's without being triumphalist here, we have decimated Al-Qaeda over the course of the last decade. Al-Qaeda Central has largely ceased to exist as an organization. There are splinter groups. It's like hitting mercury. There are little drops of Al-Qaeda in other places, but it no longer presents, in my eyes, a strategic threat to the United States mm-hmm. and the West. And we've done that in no small part because of the stability, such as it is, of the Afghan government, the presence of American bases in the region, not just in Afghanistan. And so we are holding on to those to try to continue. We are not going to eliminate every terrorist, but we can do a pretty good job of making them keep their heads down and prevent them from plotting or executing attacks on the United States again. That's why I believe we're in Afghanistan. That's why I believe we should stay and will stay in Afghanistan for many years to come.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you support the idea of negotiating with the Taliban or even some of the who have to have some kind of affiliation, some of them at least, with Al-Qaeda? Well, I don't know.
Right. I mean, I was with you until the last.
Okay.
I absolutely believe we should negotiate with the Taliban. We negotiated, of course, with the Sunni insurgents in Iraq who killed many of my friends, and we were right to do so. So the nations do not have permanent enemies. They have permanent interests, and when the Sunnis decided to stop fighting against us and start fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq, something called the Anbar Awakening or SAWA, that changed the dynamics of the war. And one of the interesting historical questions is to what extent the surge, the new American counterinsurgency doctrine, American decisions to support them in that effort, in my eyes, made in some cases individually by David Petraeus without necessarily consulting his political masters, to what extent those decisions caused the turnaround in that war. But we negotiated with the Sunnis. We fought. We ended up fighting with them on our side. The Taliban, similarly, and we talked about the different ethnic and religious groups inside Iraq. We haven't done it about Afghanistan, which is a much more complicated mosaic. In many ways, the Taliban, one of the enemies, but only one of the enemies we face in Afghanistan, is a Pashto insurgency. The Pashtuns, the second largest, I believe, ethnic group in the world without their own state, the Kurds being the first. I fully believe that were the Taliban to renounce al-Qaeda, to accept the terms of the Afghan constitution, to renounce violence, I believe that they should be, and I believe that this will happen, that they will be incorporated into governance inside Afghanistan. That's how these kind of wars end, with negotiated settlements with your enemies. I'll point out that that's how all wars end, is with negotiated settlements with your enemies.
Almost out of time here, but you know, I have to ask the very obvious question about whether being a tank platoon leader or officer in Iraq has helped you as a headmaster of a boys' school.
It is a great joy working with the boys of the Haverford School. I'm a father myself. I've got a 12-year-old son. I've gone over the last 6 months from being the father of one to, in some ways, the father of 1,000. And as I think back on a decade of wars, I remember the friends I lost, those wounded forever, those struggling to recover from their wounds, in some cases from their invisible wounds. I feel extraordinarily privileged to get to work with a new generation. I've always enjoyed working with young people. I've spent much of my life helping young people think about myself, thinking about war. I'm trying to follow St. Augustine's example, and I'm trying to build a better peace here at home. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity, and feel really, really privileged to be helping build America's future of these wonderful young boys.
Well, we have talked to you several times by telephone, and John Ogles, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Delighted to be here.
And again, he's the new headmaster of the Haverford School, a prep school just outside of Philadelphia. A retired lieutenant colonel, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, and he's currently working on his memoir. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email archives, podcasts, satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.